I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, actor Fred Thompson sets the stage for a presidential bid. But first, President Bush puts forth his own plan for the world to cut greenhouse gases. In a speech today outlining his agenda for next week's G8 summit, the president called on 15 major nations to set goals by the end of next year.
By the end of next year, America and other nations will set a long-term global goal for reducing greenhouse gases. To help develop this goal, the United States would convene a series of meetings of nations that produced most greenhouse gas emissions, including nations with rapidly growing economies like India and China.
President Bush has already rejected a plan by G8 host country Germany and Chancellor Angela Merkel to reduce carbon emissions to 50% below 1990 levels by 2050. Well, joining us is Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek. He's going to be heading to Germany for the summit. Richard, we should add today the president also focused on improving trade with third world countries, debt forgiveness and aid. And in speaking about global warming, he also said the best way to achieve cleaner energy was through technology. But what is he perhaps not saying that Germany and others want to hear?
Well, there's a real sense of urgency in Europe about this issue. And it comes down to these questions of targets. You mentioned reducing by 50% these emissions by 2050, but they also wanted to curb the average rise in temperatures to 2 degrees Celsius by the end of across the century. And there are a number of targets here which express the sense of urgency about this issue that I think is more strongly felt among European governments than President Bush is expressing. Now, these are talks about talks. It's plans for future meetings. I'm not sure that's going to be enough. I think he's still going to face a lot of pressure, at least from the press in Europe, about why he can't sign up to numbers, targets, right now.
How is he being received in Europe?
Well, it's going to be hard for him to ever overcome the controversy that's dogged him throughout his presidency, even before Iraq, but certainly after Iraq. People are obviously looking to the campaign and thinking about the next phase, not just about him, but Putin obviously is on his way out, Vladimir Putin of Russia. You have a new guard with France's president, Sarkozy, Nicolas Sarkozy. So there's Tony Blair. This will be almost his last official duty as prime minister. So there's a sense of maybe, well, he's controversial, but his time is almost up. People are thinking about the future, but of course, his time isn't actually up, and he's still got some way to go in terms of all of these issues like climate change.
How would you characterize this past week for the president? Because, you know, observers have noted, gee, suddenly issues are all over the radar in advance of G8, the announcement of a ratcheting up of sanctions against Sudan, a doubling of global HIV-AIDS programs from $15 billion to $30 billion over 5 years, and today again, the issue of global warming.
Well, just to touch on the HIV-AIDS thing, it's a lot of money. This is America really taking the lead. I think there's a sense of frustration in the White House. They haven't been given credit for what they've done already and what they plan to do on these kinds of things. But clearly there's a sense of trying to inoculate themselves against criticism in this G8, show that there is a leadership role they can play that is independent of terrorism and war, and to show the president in a good light, especially as he thinks about legacy and his position in the world.
Right. Mark Silva of the Chicago Tribune wrote that the president's focus on Africa could be an attempt to legacy mold, but as you said, it's a lot of money and, you know, maybe, you know, a true passion about, you know, perhaps trying to get that money finally
right
to Africa.
Right. And look, people can do good things as they try to burnish their legacy. And I suspect for people getting antiretroviral drugs that it doesn't really matter why President Bush is doing it. It's a good thing. So look, Africa, Sudan, he's been frustrated for a long time. The G8 has been focused on Africa from Tony Blair's time. There is a history here, but clearly he's trying to make himself look good before he goes to Germany.
Hey, by the way, I wanted to ask you quickly, you mentioned Russia's President Putin. The president also seemed to be trying to repair ties with him by inviting the president to the Bush compound in Kennebunkport, Maine. I think the first time President Bush has invited a world figure to his parents' house.
Right.
Is there anything, as you mentioned, both lame duck presidents, anything that can be done to fix that relationship this late in the game?
Well, first of all, obviously the ranch in Crawford obviously doesn't do it anymore.
Apparently not.
Kennebunkport, yes, it's a special moment, but relationships have really deteriorated, whether it's about missile defense, whether it's with Britain over the spy murder that happened there by radiation. But more broadly, the kind of rhetoric that has been coming out of the Kremlin has alarmed people in the White House. I think it's too late to really change this dynamic, but President Bush is going to try again. He feels that on a personal level, he actually gets on with Putin. They like each other. But clearly, the relationship is in a bad situation right now.
Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine, on President Bush's announced agenda today for the G8 summit next Wednesday. Richard, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, actor Fred Thompson is retiring as the district attorney on the television series Law and Order, but he's setting his sights on a bigger office. There's been no official announcement yet, but Thompson is expected to establish a presidential exploratory committee in the coming days, a move that would allow him to begin fundraising. The New York Times reports today that 75 to 100 Republicans who had offered to back Thompson were urged this week to raise roughly $50,000 each for a Thompson campaign. Well, how would a Thompson candidacy change the script for the 2008 presidential race? And what can we expect when the Democrats and Republicans hold their debates in New Hampshire, starting with the Democrats Sunday, the Republicans next Tuesday? These are the first presidential debates of this campaign in New Hampshire, the state that, at least so far, holds the first presidential primary next year. We want to spend a few minutes on all of this with two veteran political reporters. David Yepsen is political columnist for the Des Moines Register. He joins us from the newspaper's office in Iowa. David, welcome.
Good to be with you.
We also have with us John Greenberg, New Hampshire Public Radio's executive editor. He's in Exeter, New Hampshire, a town he's pledged to follow. John, is it through Election Day? How long are you going to be reporting from and about Exeter?
Oh, I'll be in my listening post here, round the clock, 24/7. I'll be following Exeter all the way through the primary, and who knows, maybe beyond.
Well, and they're very aware of you. You're taking their every pulse. So I want to ask you first: are you hearing anything? It's early yet, but anything at the diner or in the streets about Fred Thompson?
Well, I would say that so far, no. But in general, people have brought his name up before, and they're interested in anybody because this issue that is looms large for both Democrats and Republicans, but absolutely for Republicans too, is electability. If they get a sense that that Fred Thompson is truly shows that sign of electability, I think a lot of people will give him a serious look.
Well, David Yepsen in Iowa, that's what we're hearing, that Republicans are, right now interested in anybody that is not the bodies that are running, that there's something missing in the top tier of Republicans. Is Fred Thompson the guy that's going to be that thing that is missing, apparently?
He could be. The grass is always greener on the other side of the fence, is a saying that we have out here in the Midwest. And a lot of Republicans look at Fred Thompson, and he sort of looms larger than life. And I think once he gets in the race and is up there as the 11th person standing in the debate, he may not look as big as he is now. Look, Republicans took a beating in 2006, and they're still rattled from that. They look at some of these polls. 2008 may not be a good year for them. And so electability is a big issue with party activists here. They want somebody who can hold on to the White House for them. And Fred Thompson certainly has that appeal.
What about the conservative factor? Because we know there's a core of conservative Republicans very disenchanted with Giuliani and John McCain, for instance, on the values or conservative issues. Mitt Romney is trying to make inroads on those issues, but some don't trust some of his more recent conversions. Does Fred Thompson maybe fill that void?
Yes. The conservatives are not happy with almost the entire field for one reason or another. And you look at the polls of activists in both parties, and you'll find three-fourths of the Democrats are satisfied with their field of candidates. And the Republican side, it's only about half. So right there, to me, is evidence that Republicans are still looking for Mr. Right, so to speak.
And John Greenberg, there in New Hampshire, just before we leave the Thompson issue, we understand Republicans up there, when David Yepsen says, reeling from 2006, they really are. And, you know, another thing that Thompson said to bring to the party is his southernness. Will that resonate in New Hampshire?
Well, I don't think that his southernness will resonate here. I mean, if anything, people up here tend to be a little bit wary of presidential candidates playing too much to the themes that play well in the South, and that's primarily the social conservative values. They just don't feel them as keenly up here. But they are looking for someone who is going to have broad appeal, so they're not going to turn that down. I mean, people are not making decisions, the broad majority of them, on hard and fast policy issues. A lot of what they're looking for in the candidates is, how does the person come across? Do they get the sense that the person can speak well on their feet, that they can connect with a broad range of voters? That's a lot of what they're looking for when they're looking at these candidates. And if Fred Thompson comes across as a good speaker, and he certainly would be based on his theater credits, then he is going to be somebody that they're going to have a sense can make that kind of connection. They will give him a hard look. But, you know, I think that the issue of these voters that we have here in New Hampshire, particularly the early ones, they are pretty tough in terms of scrutinizing what they want out of a candidate. And Fred Thompson may not continue to look as good the harder they look at
right.
him.
Well, one of the criticisms of Fred Thompson, David Yepsen, is that, you know, he doesn't have that real hard work ethic. He doesn't want to work that hard. As opposed to what we're hearing about candidate Mitt Romney, who has apparently worked very hard in Iowa. And we're talking about the campaign aspect of working hard. Who's worked very hard in Iowa, and it paid off. Mitt Romney leads your recent poll.
Yes, I think Governor Romney is doing very well in this state. He spends a lot of time here. He has good staff that get him to the right people in the right places. He has a good executive persona on the stump, a lot of appeal to a lot of Republicans. And in fact, you examine some of the polling data, it's clear that Fred Thompson would eat into some of Mitt Romney's support, going back, I think, largely to this electability business and this business of who's the good conservative. Some conservatives are still having some questions about Romney on some of the touchstone issues for them, but there's no question about it. I think Mitt Romney has clearly moved into the lead here in the early going in this state.
Well, and his organization is being credited with that. Just a quick story from the Boston Globe recently: apparently, a leading Republican activist in Iowa, someone Romney had been courting, attended a recent event for Fred Thompson. As soon as he got home, he got a call from a Romney volunteer saying, "What are you doing at a Fred Thompson event?" So obviously the Romney camp doing their homework there. And he has four campaign events in Iowa today. That's Mitt Romney. We're talking with David Yepsen, political columnist for the Des Moines Register. He's been speaking to us from Iowa. We've also been speaking with John Greenberg, New Hampshire Public Radio's executive editor. We're just taking the pulse of the presidential campaign as we head into New Hampshire debates next week. We will talk more with both of them after just a minute break here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, back with David Yepsen, political columnist for the Des Moines Register, and John Greenberg of New Hampshire Public Radio. We're talking about the 2008 presidential race, which heated up a little bit with signs that Fred Thompson's going to be jumping in on the Republican side. And also, we're looking ahead at New Hampshire. They're going to host the next round of candidate debates this Sunday, the Democrats and the Republicans next Tuesday. Those debates are going to be held at St. Anselm College in Manchester, New Hampshire. And I want to ask you both about the impact of George Bush on the race, not, of course, on the Democratic side, but on the Republican side. David Yepsen, to you first. How are the top-tier candidates handling President Bush and the war, and what are Republicans saying about that?
Well, I think they're trying to keep a respectful distance. You don't hear George Bush's name invoked that often on the stump. Unless they absolutely have to, and then they say very respectful, circumspect things. Look, President Bush is very unpopular in the country, and even among Republican activists, There is a lot of concern about the war in Iraq. I've seen polls that show over half of rank and file Republicans want to get out of Iraq. So you have a very unpopular president. Republican candidates are going to keep a respectful distance as best they can without openly breaking with him, somebody like a Ron Paul does, but the rest of them are not. And I would imagine that would be the tenor that we'll see in the debate as well.
Well, I was going to ask, though, if Fred Thompson jumps in, he obviously won't be in this next week's debate, but if he jumps in, I mean, do we know? Might he make that break? And what will happen if there's a candidate who comes in and says, instead of, as we've been hearing, you know, the candidates are being characterized and caricatured as saying, you know, I'm for staying exactly the way things are. If a candidate jumps in and says, I'm for change.
Well, you know, Robin, I think the issue here, if I can talk about the core issue.
That's John Greenberg in New Hampshire. Yep.
Is this whole notion of what do we do in Iraq? I mean, it's tough for any Republican to say anything but I'm going to be tough on Iraq. And the question then comes is that is probably going to work well for your core Republican voter. But it raises a bunch of other questions for other voters and particularly for independents. So it is a very tough situation for them. It isn't so much whether or not they talk about George Bush, but the position they take on the war. And that is just really difficult.
John Greenberg, there's another thing becoming obvious up in New Hampshire, which is a state going through some political changes. We're hearing that the Democrats' celebrity candidates, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, have to hand out tickets to their events because they have to limit the size. I mean, thousands of people turning out. Republicans, on the other hand, drawing much smaller crowds.
Well, let's take it back to the war in Iraq. There are many Republicans who are not optimistic about what's going to happen in Iraq, even if they want a strong, forward-leaning position from their presidential candidate. They just don't necessarily feel like this is a winning issue, and they don't feel, based on the 2006 elections, that a Republican is going to hold the White House in 2008. That does not lead to massive turnout, right? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, Democrats, as David was saying earlier, they look at their roster candidates and they feel like they've got three or four good choices and they could live with any of them. The whole notion with Democrats is they get to come in with something that's always more exciting, and that is we're going to change things, right?
Right. Dave, well, that's the message. David Yepsen there in Iowa, staying with Democrats. We spoke of your polls and how they show Mitt Romney the leader on the Republican side. But looking at the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton trails John Edwards in your latest poll. What are you reading there?
John Edwards has been campaigning in this state for about 6 years. He has a very good organization. He has a good message of economic populism combined with a strong anti-war message. And so he puts together a nice package. There's concern among a lot of activist Democrats about Hillary Clinton's electability. They like her, but they're just not sure she can win. People are not ambivalent about Hillary Clinton in America, including Iowa. You either like her or you dislike her. She has a lot of unfavorables, and so the challenge for Clinton's campaign is to not necessarily change anybody's mind, but just find the people that like her and to get her out on caucus night. The wild card factor is Barack Obama right now. I mean, he's a new, exciting candidate. He gets big crowds. We see this phenomenon here in Iowa, as you do in New Hampshire, of much larger and more excited Democratic crowds than Republican ones. And certainly Barack Obama has the ability to do that. The challenge for Obama will be whether he can bottle and can the support that he gets at these rallies and turn it out on a caucus night, which is arguably a more difficult organizational task than even getting people to turn out and vote in a primary.
And David, I just want to comment. Joe Biden is the only Democratic presidential candidate campaigning in Iowa today. And you write about him in your column today. Right now he looks like a long shot, but you remind us that at this point in 2003, Howard Dean and Richard Gephardt were leading the Democratic field.
I know, it is so early. I mean, we all follow this very closely, and the activists follow it very closely, but we're 7 months away, and that's an eternity in politics. We've got a lot of debates. There's plenty of opportunity for somebody to make a mistake or a gaffe. events will affect this race. I mean, Howard Dean started to collapse when Saddam Hussein got arrested. There are outside events like that that will alter the nature of this race and keep people like all of us gainfully employed covering it.
Yeah. John Greenberg, we've only got a minute, and I hate to do this to you, but I just, you know, we've got the debates coming up in New Hampshire this weekend and next week. And we note today that the governor of New Hampshire has signed a bill authorizing civil unions in the state.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
How much is that going to be, something perhaps unheard of a few years ago?
Well, I mean, I just think that speaks to the changing tenor of the state. As an issue that plays itself out in the debate, either the Democratic or the Republican one, I don't think that it's going to matter very much. I think that what you've got here is, according to what I've been hearing from people, a number of people are using these debates. They're going to be actually engaging some of them for the first time in paying attention to these candidates. That's
right.
What happens when you've got a debate in your backyard.
John Greenberg, New Hampshire Public Radio. David Yepsen, political columnist of the Des Moines Register. Thanks for helping us take the temperature of the campaign.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still ahead. Actor Don Cheadle on sanctions against Sudan. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This week, President Bush announced new sanctions against Sudan. Since 2003, when members of ethnic African tribes in the Darfur region of Sudan rebelled against what they saw as a neglectful government, over 200,000 people have been killed and 2.5 million displaced in violence perpetrated by the Janjaweed, the Arab militias backed by the government. The new U.S. sanctions target 30 companies controlled by the government of Sudan and one company suspected of shipping arms to Darfur, as well as three individuals. Well, actor Don Cheadle and activist John Pendergrass' best-selling book, Not on Our Watch, The Mission to End Genocide in Darfur and Beyond, calls sanctions the international scarlet letter. Don Cheadle took up Darfur as a cause after reenacting another genocide. He played hotel manager turned activist Paul Rusesa Biginya in Hotel Rwanda. John is senior advisor to the International Crisis Group and a leader of Enough, the project to abolish genocide and mass atrocities. Well, they both join us now. And, John, I want to start with you. Your thoughts on the president's call.
We're starting down the road, finally, the right road, which is to impose a cost for the commission of genocide. The problem is the cost isn't high enough in Sudan. And I think that in order to increase that cost, we have to take it multilaterally, have to work very assiduously through the United Nations Security Council to take the actions that we've taken unilaterally and make them multilateral.
Well, the Associated Press reports that the UN has already drafted a resolution. We'll begin to discuss it next week, potentially. And when you say multilaterally, just be a little more clear about that.
Well, you got a great opportunity now. You have China, which is becoming increasingly nervous about its role in Sudan because of an international campaign that's been launched by activists about its role there. You have France with a new president who has said he wants to do more. You have the president of the United States who's finally decided that it's important that they actually act. Those are the three countries in the world that have the most leverage. We should be working directly with those three countries 24 hours a day until we get some action on this crisis in Darfur.
Don Cheadle, we hear that a Chinese official said after President Bush announced his sanctions that he had been taken to a refugee camp and there was no suffering.
Well, maybe he should have been asked to define suffering, because to me, people living in plastic and mud tents at the mercy of the elements without proper food, potable water, or any sort of medical assistance is suffering. It's suffering of the highest level, and it's a suffering that we've known about now for years. This is not Rwanda, which happened in 100 days, and people could honestly say, I knew nothing about it. This is a situation that's been happening for years now. Right. It's in the second phase of the genocide, where the government forces and the militia are stopping aid workers and attacking aid workers from getting to these people.
John Prendergast, we've spoken of the companies. Were the right individuals targeted? I mean, we understand that sanctions are going to target Sudan's State Minister of Humanitarian Affairs. He's been accused of war crimes by the International Criminal Court, Sudan's head of intelligence, and the leader of a rebel group that refused to sign the peace agreement. But you both write about a man named Ghosh.
Yeah, Salah Abdallah Ghosh. He's the head of the overall security head for the... He's very much in a background actor. I mean, he was hard to find any kind of video footage of him. He stayed in the background since this government came to power in a military coup in 89. and he wants it that way, and he's been a very close interlocutor of the CIA on counterterrorism issues, so he's basically operating under some form of protection.
He's even brought here because of this very relationship.
Yep, in 2006, as Don's saying, he was flown by private jet by the CIA to Langley, to the CIA's headquarters, to debrief about al-Qaeda and his knowledge about that. So we have to make a decision. Do we value human life in Darfur enough that we can challenge people who otherwise are providing us with some service on the counterterrorism? Or can we do both? Can we walk and chew gum at the same time?
And let's remind people, the U.S. has decided, and many would say that the president of Sudan has cleverly manipulated the thinking that Sudan can play a role in counterterrorism. And so as long as they keep giving up sort of just niblets of thought about terrorists that might be in the region, they kind of hold the U.S. in a catch-22.
That's the question we're asking, is this trickling of information to us about something that is obviously very important to us, our own national security, does that still mean that genocide is acceptable? Does that still mean the GOS can fly planes painted white with the UN on them and do bombing raids on villages? Is that acceptable because we're giving this information? Or is that something that, as signatories of the Convention of Genocide, that we must stand up to stop?
Where do you see the UN in all of this? And we should say the president held off announcing sanctions to give the UN more time to find a diplomatic solution. But then over this past weekend, Sudan's president, al-Bashir, reiterated his opposition to the deployment of, I think, upwards of 22,000 troops, joint UN and African Union forces. Right now, there's just a handful.
And EU.
And right now, there's just a handful of African Union troops in the region. You have said in your book that you think that if the UN could mobilize other actors, that the killing could end tomorrow. I mean, do you really believe that?
Absolutely. I think years and years of empirical evidence across the continent of Africa have shown that once the international community becomes serious, once a real partnership between African institutions like the AU and outsiders, governments like the United States and Britain and France, work together, it's very rapidly we can bring these kinds of crises to a close.
Don, I just want to ask you, throughout the book, you sprinkle references to your film work, you know, Ocean's 12, Crash. But, you often write that you feel this crazy disconnect. What am I doing here? You know, I'm an actor. And yet, throughout the book, you both point out just ordinary people who have become a part of this effort. Do you really think that pressure from average Americans will move governments to do something?
I'll take it a step further. I think in our country specifically, that the pressure from ordinary individuals and from upstanders, as we call them, is why we're seeing the kind of response that we're seeing. When John and I first started talking to people and gathering, trying to go to gatherings, there would be six people in the room. And when we went on our book tour, there were literally thousands of people, 2,000 to 3,000 of people at every venue we went to. I was asked to testify for the Senate, and I was called to meet with Condi Rice. And I think none of these things would have happened had there not been this large activism, this big collective citizens movement.
On the other hand, it's also a little heartbreaking. You read about kids raising thousands of dollars at a college fundraiser, or you, Don Cheadle, put on a pair of boots that Timberland makes that, you know, reminds people of Darfur when they look at your feet. You still feel like, well, wait a minute, you know, people are still dying. John, as someone who's a peace activist, here you are perhaps pushing for troops. Do you think U.S. troops, you know, should be going in to the Darfur region?
In fact, the opposite. I think we've really tried to argue strenuously that there are non-military means that need to be deployed now, ramping up this sanctions regime, but doing it through the United Nations Security Council. Getting a really tough resolution out of New York in the next couple of weeks is going to be the most critical endeavor. And Americans, all of this country, should be calling their elected officials to tell the president to make it an urgent priority that we expend some of the leverage we spend every day on Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan and North Korea, just put a little bit of that towards Sudan, towards getting a real resolution that will get the attention of the people committing genocide in Sudan.
Activist John Prendergast, actor Don Cheadle, their book is Not on Our Watch, The Mission to End Genocide in Darfur and Beyond. Thanks, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And before we go today, is it a bird? Is it a plane? Well, it's both. And it's Art at the Airport from Christopher Janney. You're listening to Here and Now. U.S. men leave Paris in haste. Anaheim gets its Mighty Ducks lined up en route to a Stanley Cup. And we have red hot socks, but no rockets glare at Fenway. Here to explain all of this. Did I sound like a sportscaster?
Absolutely. You did that very well.
Yeah, host of NPR's Only a Game, Bill Littlefield. Hi, Bill.
Hey.
First, a study to be published today. It links clinical depression among retired professional football players to the number of concussions they sustain while playing. Meanwhile, the NFL, setting up its own study of concussions on retired players, continues to assert that concussions have no long-term effects.
Right. It's worth noting, Robin, that this study is not being published in a comic book. It's being published in a reputable
medical journal.
And it's a shame that the National Football League and the people, the doctors involved with the NFL and with the individual teams, seeing as the league is supposed to be studying the effects, long-term effects of concussions, it's a shame that they couldn't say, let's take a look at this study, which has been done by somebody else, and see how it coincides with what we're finding out. Instead, they've responded in typical National Football League form, which is to say, this study's no good, this is ridiculous, this is anecdotal, we're not going to pay any attention to it. It's all defensive. And it's a shame, because I had hopes, after what the commissioner had recently been saying, that the NFL was really going to study this.
Okay, well, parents with football-playing kids should pay attention.
Absolutely, or with grandfathers who played in the NFL 25 years
right.
ago.
To the French Open in Paris, all nine American men out after the first round, notably number three seed Andy Roddick, who, after being offered a DVD of his humiliating loss to 125th-ranked Igor Andrin of Russia, said, no thanks, I don't want to ever see that again. Is it just American men and French clay bad mix?
Yeah, I don't know if it's all in their heads or all in their red-stained feet
yeah.
or what it is, but it does seem to be a bad mix.
Yeah. On the other hand, five of the 10 American women who entered the tournament survive, including the Williams sisters. Oh, there was a match between the raindrops early on. Venus and Serena are in, but can they get past, the old roadblocks, Maria Sharapova and Justine Annan?
Yeah, well, of course, with the Williams sisters, it's not so much a question of getting past as it is of steamrolling. I mean, that's the way they tend to play when they're playing
well.
They overpower whoever happens to be on the other side of the net. And assuming that the rain holds off long enough so that this tournament can be completed before the next Grand Slam tournament is supposed to begin, I don't see any reason to doubt that both Williams sisters will play very well throughout.
Okay. Okay. We've been hearing from some listeners who object to how much we, based here in Boston, talk about the Red Sox. But we're going to anyway, because, chances are we may not be able to later in the season.
And that's of little faith.
Yes. I'm a Red Sox fan. They have the best record in baseball. They're 10.5 games ahead of second place Baltimore in the American League East. 13.5 games in front of the tied for last place Yankees, which, so it's the last day in May, but we understand your Only a Game colleague, Gabe O'Connor, has some statistics on what it will take for the Yankees to catch the Sox.
Gabe figured out that if the Sox play 500 ball from here on in, and I think it's a safe assumption that they may be capable of doing that, the Yankees will have to be something like 70-40, 30 games over 500 from here on.
But here's the thing. I still don't feel safe.
No, well, it's not.
It's not in my DNA.
It's not in the DNA or the air here within 495 to feel that way.
Just one more note. The Sox have their three-game series against the Yankees tomorrow here in Boston, but the anticipated return of Roger Clemens to Fenway, the Rocket, will not take place. He's going to instead make his 2007 return debut against the White Sox in Chicago on Monday. Disappointing?
Well, I'm disappointed, Robin, because I root for stories, and this would have been a great story to have Roger Clemens making his first appearance in 2007 with the Yankees against the Red Sox here in Fenway Park, and that is not going to be the case. They've decided to play it safe, or maybe the Yankees are so confident that they're sure they don't even have to win in Boston this weekend.
Okay, in half a minute, I'm going to try to get this in. In the National Hockey League Finals, Ducks of Anaheim remain mighty, lead the Ottawa Senators 2-0 in the series. The Ducks' defense has been aggressive. Can Ottawa find a way to overcome it, Bill?
I hope so. We got emails this week saying all of Canada is, in fact, behind the Senators, and I would hate to see them shut out because that would be just awful for all of Canada.
The entire country. Bill Littlefield. More each week on NPR's Only a Game. Thanks, as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Still to come, sound sculptor Christopher Janney here and now.
I'm
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. If you pass through Boston's Logan Airport this summer, leave the moving walkway connecting Terminal C with the 8-story central parking garage.
Caution, moving walk is nearing its end. Please watch your step. Thank you.
As you enter the atrium space next to the elevator bank,
please insert credit card below or pay with cash to the right.
And pay for your parking ticket.
Please take your credit card.
You'll hear... What? What is that?
I hear a bird.
It's a nest in here.
You think it's a nest?
Oh, sure. We got a nest in here. Yeah. Can't you hear them?
Birds?
Yeah.
Yeah, aren't they here all the time?
They are.
They're always here. Makes me more relaxed.
Well, you're actually hearing what I call the sound environments of New England. Everything from the shores of Cape Cod to the rivers of New Hampshire to the mountains of Maine.
That's Christopher Janney, artist, architect, musician, and creator of sound and light environments called Architecture of the Air. It's a passion that began with his college thesis at MIT, SoundStair, a series of steps with sensors that trigger synthesizers. One SoundStair is now installed at Boston's Museum of Science.
And a lot of times people say, what is your name? And I tell my name, and I said, oh, well, you might know that I did the, oh, you're the guy that did the stairs, you know. Or in New York, I have the piece in the New York City subway. Oh, you're the guy that did the subway. I go through there every week, you know.
In his New York subway project, Reach, riders wave their hands at the train to produce sound. In 1999's Heartbeat, Mikhail Baryshnikov wore Christopher's sensors and danced to his own heartbeat. There have been dozens of Christopher Janney projects across the country. Now, here at Logan, Rainbow Cove Red and Rainbow Cove Green, two new installations at Terminals C and B. Glass walls and shades of red and green. 38 sound speakers playing a mix of 8 tracks of the sounds of birds, frogs, and insects.
All part of the composition.
When you say you wrote this, mm-hmm. if you said this, if you say you wrote mm-hmm. this, what do you mean by that?
Well, as a composer and a jazz composer, yeah, and an architect, I compose music, but I allow for other elements to enter in whenever they like. So all the various sounds that you hear are actually sounds that I've either created or digitally enhanced from various sound files. And then it's sitting in a computer, and the computer is calling up different sounds and different groups of sounds based on both the time of the day and also the density of activity in the space. You hear the melodic aspects that trigger from people actually pushing the buttons to call the elevator.
Let's go. Can we go do that?
Yeah, of course.
So we walk over to the elevator bank.
Now, if I push this. So if I'm calling the elevator to go up, the trill will go up. Here's the elevator going down. The trill will go down. Nobody recognizes that but me, but that's all right. So now we'll go in.
Okay, we go in the elevator.
And now the sound environment's in the elevators. Okay. And you will go up to 7. There's a sound that triggers as it goes by each floor. That's for blind. And then when the door opens, you get that bell tree.
Okay, so we get the whoosh when the door opens.
And then you're up here on the 7th floor, where it's, you know, much more quiet.
Oh, and by the way, look at this view. We're looking out at the town of Winthrop, which is, it's a New England town.
Right. And also, and you also have the water, you know, which is an important part of the New England landscape.
These are peepers.
That's right. Those are frogs. You see, there's different kinds of frogs. And then you heard an owl. So now you see you've moved. You've moved away from the shores of Cape Cod, and now you're somewhere in a forest. And it's really designed more for people you know, maybe they come through this airport once a week, you know, commuters. So the whole idea is to compose something that never sounds the same way twice.
It's not a loop. This isn't a loop.
No,
just running.
No.
It also is the difference between, art and music. I mean, a lot of people just pump sound into an elevator. But this is what?
This is really the intention of this is to give a very a sonic portrait, I like to say. I only use the sounds that are indigenous to that part of the country. Muzak has a lot to do with creating a work environment where people will work harder between 2 and 5 and things of this nature. And this is really my intention here is to create something that is soothing and relaxing.
It's getting later in the day at the Peeper Pond.
You know, these to me are, as an architect, these are materials to me. It's just like concrete and steel. It's about trying to create interesting and, in this case, comfortable environments, making a harmonious architecture, and really trying to make an architecture that is welcoming.
What are you trying? I mean, I've seen pictures in your book of people touching buildings in ways they wouldn't before.
Yeah, so you know, I think that's part of what interests me as an architect is trying to what I say chip away what's called the urban alienation, especially in cities. It's so dense that people don't relate to one another. Part of what my work tries to do is try to create conditions where people will interact with one another and create a more welcoming kind of environment.
I'm reminded of your Baryshnikov project when we heard his heart. And I'm just wondering if a part of this is to give a building a heartbeat.
Well, it's definitely trying to give a building a personality. And, training as an architect and a jazz musician, my interest is to, on the one hand, try to make architecture more like music, trying to make it more spontaneous, more alive. And on the other hand, sometimes trying to make music more like architecture, and that's really what the heartbeat piece with Baryshnikov was about. I mean, that's a whole series of works that I call physical music.
We can only go down if we're on the top floor.
We just press.
We'll go all the way down to one.
We're not going anywhere.
Didn't you work with David Byrne, and he actually came to an understanding that he was sort of backwards?
I do a series called Resonating Frequencies where I invite one architect and one musician and we do an evening of talking about contemporary ideas. And actually David's contention was that the venue shapes the music. You can't play arena rock in a small club. When musicians realized that they could play 50,000-seat stadiums, they started writing songs like We Will Rock You. And being trained as an architect, when I come into a space, I think about what's going to sound good in this space. I think the idea is to try to think of ways to make enhance your everyday experience by giving you these artistic experiences, not just as a special event while you might go to the theater or go to a movie, but literally on your way to work.
That may be. But as I left Logan Airport, I bumped into the Moran family of Bridgewater, Massachusetts. Dad and 3 kids, 6 to preteen, riding the elevators of Christopher Janney's Rainbow Cove Blue, as if it were an amusement park ride.
Cool. Oh.
What do you guys think of these sounds?
Isn't that neat?
Cool.
What is it? You know what it is?
Birds and frogs.
Birds in Massachusetts. Sounds from Massachusetts.
I heard a river flowing, or like a pond or something flowing.
Oh, yeah. Let's listen. You can see all of Christopher Janney's work in the book Architecture of the Air, The Sound and Light Environments of Christopher Janney. His Rainbow Cove installations in Boston are at Terminal C and B. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio.